It's the time of year when we're all thinking about goals and priorities. Now is the time to plan your next trip. Whatever kind of travel fills you up, whether it's lounging on the beach, connecting with family and friends, or going on a foreign adventure, Expedia has the tools you need to plan a great trip. Download the Expedia app or visit Expedia.com to start planning. You do need to be a One Key member to use price tracking. Signing up is easy and free. Expedia, made to travel.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time. Taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now.
So I want to say hello to you, Dr. Dennis McGuigge. Thank you for joining me for our O Talks and for our Super Soul Sunday podcast. I have to tell you, I have witness your great works on the world stage for quite some time now. And I consider this a day of honor and privilege for me to be able to talk to you. So I just want to tell the world who you are. Everybody knows that you won the Nobel Peace Prize and that you are a world-renowned doctor and human rights activist who has dedicated your life to caring for survivors of sexual violence in a way that almost nobody else has in the world. And now a published author, I would have to say, I am so honored to call this an Oprah book with Flatiron. You know, I believe wholeheartedly in this title of the power of women. And, you know, I wanna do something in this interview that I've never done in the thousands of interviews I've done over the years. I would like to begin with a moment of silence in honor, in reverence to all of the lives that you saved and those that you lost. Yeah. Thank you for that. And I have to say that in reading The Power of Women, I wanted to be a part of the publishing of this book and getting it out into the world. But in reading it, I thought, you are some kind of special human being. Obviously, the forces of life that many of us call God had its hand in your life to become who you have in the world. And as I read your memoir, The Power of Women, A Doctor's Journey of Hope and Healing, I couldn't help thinking that your work as a doctor who actually specialized first in maternal health, you were thinking you were going to be working in maternal health, that it was fated. Mainly, I think, starting with both of your parents' mothers died in childbirth. So I want to know how that factored into your choice of becoming a doctor.
Yeah, thank you so much. I want to thank you for supporting this book. And I think that really, for me, is meaningful that I can get this interview with you. When really I was very young, 8 years old, at this moment, my father was a pastor, and I used to follow him in his ministry. And something really touched me when I saw my father praying for a child who was sick. And I think this was something very powerful for me to see that my father could just pray and don't give medicines. So I asked my father, why you just pray and you don't give medicines? And my father answered me, I'm not a medical doctor. And this was very new for me, because a father is, for a child, he's someone who can do everything. And right. There I discovered that he could just pray and he can't give medicine. And for me, I just tell him, you know, when I'm myself sick, you are just not praying for me, but you are also giving medicine. I think that this discussion with my father was really something very strong in me. And I take it as a convention with my father to become a medical doctor so I can support, I can support him in his ministry in giving medicines. But when I become adult and talking with my mother, there I could learn what happened to the mother of my father and her own mother. They died in really just after delivery. And this was really a terrible thing. And you, in all my history, I think that myself, I just, if I'm alive today, it's because my mother was a strong woman, a powerful woman. She fought to save my life. And all these things together, I think that is the reason that today I'm doing what I'm doing. I can say that it's really a long story. And this story starts very early in my life and the life of my parents.
Don't go anywhere. More to come after this short break.
No two travelers are exactly alike, and that means no two trips should be either. Texas' vast landscape of cultures, regions, destinations, and activities allow for an infinite number of different travel experiences. Are you a beach person? Well, you'll be having fun under the sun with Texas' 350 miles of coastline. If you're more of a rugged vacation type, there are campgrounds, hiking trails, and state parks galore. And foodies can't get enough of Texas' world-famous barbecue and Tex-Mex. Enjoy live music, visit internationally recognized art museums, and check out thrilling cowboy experiences. And now, Travel Texas offers a one-of-a-kind online trip builder that allows users to generate a custom, visually-led trip matched to their unique interests. Visit traveltexas.com/get-your-own to get the only trip to Texas that matters, yours. That's traveltexas.com/get-your-own. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank. Some things should be boring, like banking. Boring is safe and reliable. You don't want your bank to be entertaining. Entertaining is for podcasts with inspiring celebrity guests, not banks. PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life. PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865. Brilliantly boring since 1865 is the service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
Yes, and it's so highly unlikely that you, coming from the background that you came from, would actually even end up being a doctor, born in a shack and faced, you know, turbulent times in your native country of the Congo. Medical school must have seemed completely out of reach at the time, but your mother, who you call your first hero in many ways, made it possible for you to become a doctor, right?
I think that she supported me a lot. I can even say that sometime I was asked a way to just abandon my ambition to be a medical doctor, but she used all her intelligence and to support me and to just bring me on the way of to be a medical doctor. It was not easier in my country, of course, but really, I can say that my mother, she helped me to bring me back on my ambition. And today I can really be, I can recognize her for what she did to support the ambition and bring me on the right way.
Well, and you write that it was because the Congo faced a maternal healthcare crisis that you made the decision to become an OBGYN, not a pediatrician, as you'd originally planned. What was that maternal healthcare crisis at the time?
Yeah, of course. At the beginning, my ambition was to be a pediatrician. And I did all that I could do to become pediatrician. But when I started to work in a remote area in Lemera Hospital, there really I found another reality. And there I was working in the hospital where we could lose two women per day in the during the delivery, and most of women were coming to the hospital bleeding, coming from the remote area without transportation, without the possibility to take care of them. And I started just to discover that to take care of babies, we need also to get their mother alive. And after 1 year working in this condition where really maternal mortality was something that people are just seeing, could see it like a normal thing. It was a kind of fatalism. A mother today was just as a normal thing in this village. And especially, I can remember one day, a woman who just before to deliver, she told me she did her last ward before to get in the ward, and just I understand that why women can feel that to be pregnant is just to be between the death and the life, and in other places this is not really a terrible thing to be pregnant. And there I decide to say, okay, maybe I can be in another, maybe to be obstetrician, where I can work with mother, but also to support children. So I changed my ambition just when I saw that it was possible to do more than only to take care of babies.
And we see that the maternal healthcare crisis that still goes on in the Congo, and in fact has gotten worse, is a reflection of women's lowly status in the society. How and when did you make that connection?
I think in Congo today, what we can see, even today, I can say that even today, we have a big problem. Congo is one of the countries where the maternal health is the obstetrical care is really very, very, very low. And the women are not getting enough support when it comes to the maternal health. And for me, the connection between is because you can't get babies if you don't have mothers in a good health. And when you are working with maternal health, you have also to take care of babies. And for me, the connection was there. Just I say, okay, I have already did my thesis in pediatrics, but now if I can complete my training the obstetrical care for women, there maybe I can be more effective to support women, and to help women to don't fear to be pregnant, and because there is no reason for women to be fear when they are pregnant. But yeah, in Congo, really, this is a big.
It's, and you realize this to a great extent when you spent some time in France as a doctor, and your eyes were opened, and you realized that women there rarely, if ever, died in childbirth. That was a big revelation, right? Or aha moment for you.
Exactly. Or I spent 5 years in maternity, and I have never seen a woman die in the delivery room. And, yeah, and for me, this was a shock. Why it can be like that in France and not in my country? Why women in my country can be in this situation, that they know that to be pregnant is a big risk to lose their life? So I think that for me, this was really very touching. And it was also a motivation to say, we can make a difference. We can change things in a good way for women of Congo.
So I wanted to just say that women were dying in childbirth in large numbers because of the lack of trained professionals, of doctors, of nurses, of midwives, to actually see them through labor and delivery. But you know, it's so interesting how we all start out with plans for our lives, because I thought I was going to be a fourth grade teacher because I love my fourth grade teacher so much. And I ended up using television as a platform for teaching, because God had a bigger dream. You know, the forces of my life moved me in a different direction than being a fourth grade teacher. And you started out in maternal health, and then the atrocities in Rwanda occurred. You described your primary focus was maternal women's health until the genocide in Rwanda jumped the border into the Congo, and sexual violence against women spiked and became more of the norm than not. How did that change you?
Yeah, exactly. And this is really the, what can I say? It's how my life is changing with circumstances. Yeah. And
you thought you were going down one path, then that war happens and it takes you someplace else. So exactly. When did you know that you were going to now spend your life trying to save victims of rape?
In the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda, 2 years after the war started in Congo. And this the war in Congo is really a war on the body of women. And it was my first time to see these terrible things, how human beings can be so, do atrocity on the body of women. And I was not prepared to really to take care of women in this circumstance, because there is no books talking about this kind of violence on women to destroy their genital and so on. But for me, I was there, and I just feel that I should do something to support and help women who come to my hospital with all these terrible wounds on their genitals. And I just treat the first, the second, and after 3 months, I just found that I already treat 45 women with the same stories. I was raped, and after to rape me, they shoot on my genitals, they burn, they introduce bayonets and things like that. And at this moment, really, I didn't think that I will do this kind of things for 20 years. And today is now 20 years, these things is happening, and it's still happening. Even last week before to leave Congo, I was just in my operating room operating a young girl of 6 years. And it's just terrible, but when I just changed to become a doctor.
Being a young girl of 6 years, did you just say a young 6 year old?
Yes, exactly. Six years old. Yeah, she was raped, and all her genital was completely destroyed. And they brought her to the hospital, and we just operate her to. And I think that now I have already operated more than 60,000 women with different kind of wound on their body. Yeah. Well, and I can say that I was not prepared for that. My goal was to support, at the beginning it was to support children, and after I move and I become obstetrician to support women, and now it's really what I'm doing is just to treat all this kind of atrocities on women. And I think that this is really something that has to change.
One of the reasons why I wanted to support you in publicizing this book is to let people know that this is still going on. And you describe the atrocities some of your patients had experienced. I mean, reading the book is in itself venturing into a world that for most people is unthinkable. Unthinkable when being shot in the genitals, made to squat over a fire, having your genitalia you're burned, being raped in front of your husband or your children, and even at times having the children being forced to join in on those rapes. And you write that what human beings can do to other human beings sometimes shocks you. And I just want to read from the book where you say, at various, now I was changing again, owing to events beyond my control, to become a specialist in treating rape injuries. And at various points, particularly at the beginning, but not only then, I have doubted whether I could carry on. I have felt my work crush my spirit. Sadness descend on me like a shroud. It has sometimes shaken my faith in my fellow human beings. There is only so much anyone can take of witnessing bodies, lives, and communities being torn apart. So what has enabled you to carry on from 45, those first 3 months, to now 60,000 women?
What really is, I can say, supporting me in what I'm doing is the strength of women. I could never imagine how women are strong, because most of the women, when they come to our hospital, they are in the situation that I can say, and say it really. I have treated some men, and what touched me is when men in the same condition, when they have their, for example, their, it happens that their sex is cut or things like that to men. I have never seen a man who can stand up again and say, I'm a man, I want to go on fighting for my right, for the right of others. But what is really so touching for women, even if they are destroyed completely, even if the you can just get impressions that they will never stand up again, but in treating women, I'm so touched with this courage and this strength that women have to stand up. And when they stand up, they're not stand up only for themselves. This is really very special. I think that when women stand up, they stand up for their right, but also for the right of their children, the right of the community. They are just, when it happened to women, they become, most of them become activists fighting for the right of others. And this is really so touching for me, and to feel how women are strong, how they are power, because the power of women is not for themselves, is for how they can empower the entire community, their family, and their children.
And that's why you call the book The Power of Women. I love the story exactly. That you tell, that it's impossible to care for men after they're suffering, because they go through so many mental health problems. You can't get through to them. They have trouble living with the fact that they are going to now be handicapped in some way, but that for almost every woman, they manage to find a sense and new meaning for their existence, which is just incredible.
Macy's Mother's Day gift guide has the perfect gift to make mom feel special. Shop by price, like 25 and under to 100 and under. Category, like fragrance, handbags, and more. Or gift lists, like for the mom who has everything. Gifts that are already wrapped and ready to be gifted, and for grandma. Get top gifts like Dolce & Gabbana Devotion Eau de Parfum, Coach Floral Printed Leather Cassie Crossbody Bag, and Le Creuset Shallot Dutch Oven. Shop at Macy's.com/giftfinder. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
And the book is filled with story after story of incredible women. I want you to tell us about Bernadette. You say she is an exemplar of resilience. She was stopped by soldiers and shot in her vagina, y'all. Shot in her vagina. And not only did she pick herself up and go and get help, which I can't even imagine that, after enduring multiple surgeries and dashed hopes for having children, she became a skilled caregiver herself.
Yeah, I think that she's one of the wonderful women I treated in the hospital. And really, I can't even believe what she's doing today to support others. And when she was doing her courses, and I asked her, why do you want to be anesthetic? And she said, you know, doctor, I suffer a lot when it happened to me. You can't imagine to be shut in the vagina and destroy the rectum, to destroy the bladder. Everything was completely destroyed when she came to the hospital. And I was not even thinking that I can treat her and she can get healing. But when really she told me that she wants to be a nurse, and after to finish her school of nurse, she said, no, I think that the better thing is to do a specialization in anesthesia so I can support other women to don't really suffer as myself. I suffer when they did this atrocity on my body. And you can't imagine to someone who suffer like that and say, I don't want other to suffer as myself. I suffer when they shoot on me. And today she's working in our operating room to support other women, to take care of them. And just, it's like she know exactly what can happen and how the suffering is, and to support others. For me, all these women are just my hero, because she could be maybe very angry with others and say, why it happened to me, why I was not protected by the society, and treat the society as just bad people who didn't support her. No, the opposite is to say, I don't want others to suffer. And this for me is just something so touching.
There's also Womazila, who as a teenager was captured by soldiers and tied to a tree, where she was repeatedly raped by anybody who felt like it for a year. What did you do to help her survive that horrific experience, medically and psychologically? Because you all realized shortly after performing these surgeries that you needed more than just physical rehabilitation, physical therapy, that there is a whole trauma process that needed to be instilled in order to help these women. But let's talk about Womazila, who as a teenager was captured by soldiers and tied to a tree. How did, you know, when I read that story, I was like, I don't know how you maintain your sanity when something like that happens to you. How did she stay sane?
At the beginning, I was just treating them physically. And after 6 months, I could discover that to treat them physically was not enough, because the people who raped them, the goal was to destroy them not only physically, but especially to destroy them mentally. And in destroying them, in doing this kind of atrocities in front of the family, their children or the husband, is not only to destroy the women, but it's also to destroy all the family, the community. And when we start to treat women physically, we could see really that it was not enough to treat them physically. So after 6 months, we start really to think, because what we could see, it was that after to treat them and to ask them to go back home, it was difficult. They will just coming with other complain, asking other treatment, and even if physically we could not see anything, but the problem was there. So we introduced to support them psychologically. And this was like really something to change completely the life of women. When we start to support them psychologically, we could see that at the end, they were really able to take their life and support themselves and change really their life. And this was the second pillar of our treatment. But this was not enough because, you know, when it happened to women to be raped in front of all the community, they are excluded, rejected by the community.
Right.
So the third thing that we did, or the third pillar or of our holistic care, was to support women economically, so they can be enough strong economically, mm-hmm. so they can be autonomous and live without to be supported by men or by the community. And this was really magic, because when women are strong enough economically, there you don't need really to give them the place in the society. They will take it themselves because they are enough strong to say what they want and to take care of themselves. And at the end, we could see that when women are physically not bad, psychologically, because they can't forget, but they are enough strong to fight for themselves and fight for their own rights, and economically, when they are enough strong economically, the last thing that women were asking us was justice. And I can say that this is really, it's one thing. To treat them physically, psychologically, to support them economically, and to get justice is a way that women can just understand that, okay, it happened to me, but the community understands that it was not my fault. It was not, I didn't really look for what happened to me. And for women, I think that justice is very important.
Is this still the case now, Dr. McGwege, that women are still being blamed for their own rapes?
Now, I think that the society starts to change a little bit. But mm-hmm. when it comes to justice, we still have a problem.
Yeah.
We still have a problem. And really, this is really a challenge for what we are doing, because now we have a lot of women who are seeking justice because the perpetrators are there, they can see them, and they're still in power, they are in armies, they are in the police or the administration. And this is not normal, because it's like just to say, okay, it happened to you, it's not a matter. But we need, now women are pushing to get justice. And what I want to say also is, when women are asking justice, it's not because they want to get something back. They want just to be recognized as victims.
Right.
And for the society, this is very important.
Well, you say sexual violence is also part of the military strategy. I did not realize this until reading the book. Rape is a part of this process of ruthless exploitation. The 25 years of sexual violence in the Congo is bound up with the plundering of raw materials. But yeah. Sexual violence is also part of the military strategy. This is what I didn't realize. Of commanders. Rapes are carried out as a way of disciplining anyone suspected of failing to support the rebels. And if a community is suspected of being hostile by working with the Congolese armed forces or a rival militia, the women are the ones who are targeted. So if that is, if it's a strategy for the commanders and it's used as its own force against the communities, how is there ever going to be justice?
Yeah, I think that to use rape as a weapon in the community is a way not only to destroy women, but it's a way also to destroy all the community.
All the communities.
And
yeah.
Exactly.
Because the communities don't exist without the women. The women are holding.
Exactly.
Yes, the women.
And I think that if you can see how the community is women are supporting the community. So if you destroy women in the community is completely, completely destroyed. And this weapon of war is very efficient, because I can see how it's happening in many places where rape is used as a weapon of war. It's to destroy the fabric of the family, of the society. And when the fabric is completely destroyed, so you can just use the population as you want, because this strength of the community, when the fabric of the society is destroyed, so the society can't really resist or can't fight for himself, can't ask his own right, and the population is completely humiliated, and they are just there to accept everything. And I think that using women is a way to show men that you are not able to protect your wife. So what kind of men are you? It's really a terrible way to destroy. And even for the next generation, when women are pregnant and they can't, there is no filiation, they have children who don't have any filiation in the community, all these children are rejected by the community. So it's a kind of really evil way to destroy communities. And when the community is destroyed, so you can exploit him, you can exploit this community without any problem. And it's what is happening in Congo.
One of the things you write about violence is being like a virus, you say. It's like a contagion. And in this case, exactly. You're referring to the Rwandan genocide that skipped over the border to the Congo. And I was particularly struck by that, because you see sexual violence in this particular case in the Congo being spread like a virus.
Exactly.
We all are now very familiar with what a virus is. So being spread like a virus, imagine.
Yeah, you know, when this is happening in public, and you can imagine a child of 10 years who can see her mother rape in front of him, how you can ask to this child to respect women? It's not possible. So we have all these young soldiers, child soldiers who are, they have from their commander this order to rape women. And just when they have guns, many commanders are telling them that you have a gun so you can get everything, money, women, and so on. So when children who are 12, 14, 15 years, they just get this order from the commander to rape women. When they leave the army, the group army, they have just to go on doing it, because it become just their way of living. And so they're just using rape as they start very young. And I think that all these children are just in the society as a virus to go on raping, even if they are not in the group army. Even if they are not in the army, they become very dangerous for the society, to destroy the society, because they learn to destroy women very earlier in their life. And that is the reason in the book I said that it's like a virus in the society. And to use rape, and especially use rape in front of children, is really to destroy not only one generation, but many generations.
So how do you stop a virus?
Yeah. You know, we are really working very hard with what we call to fight against toxic masculinity. Because this virus of rape in the community, the only one way is to change the mindset of men, to understand that to destroy women is to destroy all the society. It's not only to destroy women, but it's to destroy all the society. And working against toxic masculinity for us is really education. And men need education to understand.
So you go and sit with the role. Leaders? Do you go and sit with the leaders themselves? The chiefs, the people who are in the community? communities and try to reason with them that when you rape and commit violence against the women, look at how you're destroying your entire community and everybody loses. Is that the approach?
Exactly. Our approach is to talk all with political leaders, talking with religion leaders, and to talk with all leaders in the community and talk about this question. And I can assure that we are so surprised to see that sometime when we are talking about this question, people are not realizing that this is a terrible thing. It looks like that it can happen for other women, not for my mother, for my sister, for my daughters. And just if men can start to think that, if I can't accept this for my mother, if I can't accept it for my daughter or my wife, why I can accept it for others? And just to bring people to think what they are feeling themselves when this happened to one of their relatives. And I think that discussing about this kind of question with men in schools, we are doing it in university and at many places where we can bring men together and talk about this question of toxic masculinity. You know, in many societies, talking about men in patriarchal society is like men have a power. Men must be strong. He can do everything as men and so on. And I think that all these things, we are doing it without thinking on the consequence of the education of men in our society, in patriarchal society, to just show boys that you must be strong, you can't cry, you have to. But all these things are bringing just boys to be in another way, to be so aggressive and destroying their own community.
But also because women have such a low place in society, even if that woman is your mother, if that woman is your sister, she still has such a low status in society. Tell us about the moment. I can't remember the officer's name. I don't know if he was a general or a sergeant, but some person of authority had come to visit your hospital. Yeah. And all of the women were put in the room to speak with him. And at some point, he fainted. Yeah. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, exactly. It was a general of the army. Mm-hmm. And he was a specialist in forensic legal medicine, forensic at the high level of the country. So he came at the hospital to try to see what we are doing and how we are working with this question. And he was really very proud of himself as a general and just talking about sexual violence as it was just something that we could solve with some solutions. And but when he came at the hospital, I remember a small girl of 12 years, she started to talk to him with authority, showing him how this is terrible for the community and how she was raped herself and so on. And this commander, he could not resist to these young girls who were talking with authority. And I saw how this general fall down and he started to cry and just we just bring him to help him because he was in very, very bad condition. And after this, what he told me, he was not thinking that it was so terrible for women what he could solve this day. And this is really maybe in many cases where people, when they're talking about sexual violence, they don't understand what is the consequence of the sexual violence. And this guy was a general working with a forensic in the army, but he was just thinking that he will talk with women and just give some advice to the team at the hospital. But when after to talk with victim of sexual violence, he went back completely change in his mind how mm-hmm. to see this question of sexual violence, because he could just get this testimony from a young girl.
Eve Ensler, who now goes just by the name V, wrote the Vagina Monologues, and she became very influential to you and to the patients, victims, survivors, and work that you do there. How did that evolve? I know I read that you loved how she exalted the vagina and inspired women to accept their physiology and be proud of it. You invited her to the Congo and she listened to all the women's stories, or many women's stories, and later helped raise money to found the City of Joy, which offered a safe place for rape victims. So she was instrumental in bringing attention to and helping your organization.
Yeah, exactly. When she came for us, you know, I was in New York and I got a discussion with her at the School of Law of New York. And after this moment, I asked her, I was so surprised to see that she could talk about the vagina clearly. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm an obstetrician. So I was very happy to see that this question could be, she could talk about it openly, because I'm convinced that people are not talking about vagina. It's only the way to destroy women, because we don't want to talk about it. But when we are, there is no law, there is no face and so on, things are happening in a very bad condition. And it was, for me, the first time to talk with someone who was talking about the vagina openly. So I invited her in Congo, and she came. When she came, I was at the point that really, I was psychologically, I was really very, very down, and I was just asking myself if I can go on doing what I was doing at the hospital. And now when she came, she just started to talk about her own experience when it comes to sexual violence, to talk with girls and women at the hospital. And she asked women what she could do for them, and women come with their proposal to ask if she can help them to go to a place where they can wait after to be treated, if they can wait somewhere before to go back in their own home. And I can remember that she started with dancing with women. They invite me to dance with them. And it was just a moment where I just feel this possibility to bring joy in the life of women. And I could see how themselves could express this joy to be supported by someone who has the same experience with them coming from the state. For women of Congo, it was just okay. So it is not only us, it can happen in other places, and a place as the state, if this can happen. So I think that this moment was really crucial for me, because I just feel that I got a new strength to go on with what I was doing at Panzi. And so we make the plan to get the City of Joy, and the City of Joy today is working very, very good to support 90 girls each 6 months, to support them, to help them to transform their pain in power and give them possibility to restart a new life. And it's really a good program that we are doing at the City of Joy.
You know, I fear for you. You seem to be a fearless man, but I fear for you. I lost track of how many times there have been attempted assassinations on your life. And that last one where you lost one of your trusted employees who jumped in front of you and literally saved your life. How many times have they tried to kill you?
If really I can count what I have proved that people can and try to shoot on my car, to shoot on it's around 6 times. And this is just terrible what happened when they come at my place. And I took my two girls as hostage in my house, and after start to shoot, and Joseph was killed in front of me. I don't know how I escaped. Yes, I don't know how I escaped. But what I learned for this assassination attempt was what women are enduring when this happened to them. And it was really an experience for me to understand how it's painful to leave this kind of things, because women come into the hospital, most of them, it's after to be raped with people with guns who shoot on their relatives for to get them and bring them in the forest. I think that this really brings me to understand more the victim of sexual violence I'm treating at the hospital, how they can suffer.
You've been threatened, you've been intimidated, you were supposed to speak to the UN, you were told, visited and told you absolutely will, if you speak, you will not live. They've been to your home, they've held your daughters hostage. As you said, they killed your longtime employee in the attempt to try to kill you. Do you live with fear still for your life?
Yeah, you know, when they came to my house and killed Joseph, I left Congo. Of course, for me, it was a red line. And I said, okay, I want to support women, but not at this price. I have really to live, because also I have my doctors, I have responsibility on them. And I left Congo at this moment. But I can tell you what happened to me. I have to say that.
This was the sixth attempt?
I live because...
This was the sixth attempt. This was the sixth attempt.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And at this time, I decided to leave Congo because, of course, I was afraid about what happened to me. But the big question was how I returned, or how I came back in Congo. It's mm-hmm. only because women are really very strong. Women of a small island in South Kivu, they decided to write to the president of Congo, Joseph Kabila, the president of Congo, the former president. And they wrote a letter to ask him to bring back their doctor, Denis Mukwege, have to come back. But they didn't get any answer. They wrote to the Secretary General of the UN a letter, and they sent me a copy. They didn't get any answer. And at the end, all these women together, they said, okay, if they don't want to bring him back, we have to do our action. And they start to sell fruits and vegetables and bring each Friday $50 at the hospital. And they said, we'll do it until we get the ticket for Dr. Mukwege and his family to come back. And when I received this message, I just got impression that they are joking, because the women in South Kivu, they don't have even $1 per day for themselves. How they can find the ticket to bring me back from the state? I was in Boston. So they decide to do it, and they start to collect money. And when they come to the hospital for the third, there I understand that they are determined to get this money, and they will do it, because I know how women are strong. And just I took the decision to say, I have to go back, because if I put in the balance, them and myself, of course, they are waiting very, very heavy, if you can compare with myself. So I decided to come back. And when I come back, they said, okay, now we took a decision. We'll get 25 women each day to protect you, to be around you. So we'll see who can kill 25 women before to reach you. And I can just say that this for me was the sign of the power of women, how women are strong. And when they decide to do something, no one can stop them. So I'm in Congo since 2013, and I can say that women are really the strong support for me, even if I can be intimidated.
Excuse me, that army of 25 women, do they still show up every day for you, or do you have greater protection?
Yeah, now at you know, this strength brings that the UN react, and now I have soldiers of UN who are protecting me at the hospital. I'm living in the hospital because it was very dangerous for me to live in the city. And now I'm living in the hospital. It's all, also, it was only also the one way for me to go on treating these women at the hospital. And now I have the UN who are protecting me at the hospital. But the idea came from Women of Idri.
Those 25 women surrounding the gates of the hospital. So what was your greatest fear? Dr. McGregor, what was your greatest fear that you were able to overcome, and what allowed you to overcome it?
Yeah, I think that today I have impression that my fear is that how we can succeed to get a world where women can feel safe, where women can't fear against sexual violence. And for me, I have this fear that fighting for now 20 years, I have impression that the response is really very, very true, and I would like to see the world to be mobilized and take really responsibility to understand that to fight against sexual violence is to create a world where it will be safe for women to live without fear against sexual violence. And to think about next generations, when I can think about my grandchildren, etc., I'm sometime I have this feeling that after 20 years I was hoping that maybe we can get a strong mobilization in my country, that all the people can understand that the future of the country is lying in the hands of women, and the only one way is to support them to don't fear against sexual violence, to be safe. But yes, I have a fear that the fight that we are doing maybe will be long, and this is really...
You certainly are a warrior for peace. I mean, I feel like, obviously, you've survived 6 assassination attempts. I recall the time that they shot into your office and shot through your chair, and you had just gotten up and moved to another side of the room, or had gone into another room, and they just missed you by seconds then. So obviously there is favor and a calling on what you are doing. Do you fear that now that you have spoken so boldly and that it is in print, and that the words cannot be taken back or cannot be misinterpreted, that there is a higher price on your life?
Yeah, really, this book for me is can maybe raise this the intimidation and maybe to attempt on my life. But I think that it's something that really, for me, I just this feeling that I should do it. I have to do it, because it's a way also to talk to the world about what is happening in my country, what is happening for women of Congo. And it's not only for women of Congo, because I travel around the world and I could see that women, I was in Iraq, I was in Colombia, I was in Kosovo. And I can see that this question of women, I know that it's a big risk for me to write this book, but it's also a way to just bring more people to understand. I hope that more people will read this book and understand that we have all a responsibility. Everyone can do something to make this world better for women. And everyone can ask himself the question, what I'm doing myself to get the world better, to get a world where sexual violence will not be, as we can see everywhere today, women are not safe to get a normal life because only they are women. And for me, it's a responsibility to write this book, even if I know that it can just create more intimidation and more attempt on my life. But I think that it's very important that everyone can understand that I have a responsibility to stop what is happening in the world when it comes the way that people are seeing women as weak, as inferior, and they can treat them as they want. I think that we can just change the paradigm. This book, for me, is a way to bring just the power of women, to show that women, we don't use enough the power in women. And if you want to change things in the world, is to use women where they can just do things that we men, we can do.
Well, I was going to ask you about when was the time in your life that you'd been the most brave. I think one of the most brave things you've done is to actually write down, leave the words for the rest of the world to digest as they choose about what is happening to women and the sexual violence against them. It's one of the bravest acts I've ever witnessed. And I know you've done incredible brave things, going in and rescuing women and helicoptering them out and saving their lives physically and emotionally. But this is a very brave act on your part. And I thank you for doing it, Dr. McGwecki. The book is called The Power of Women, and it's available now wherever books are sold. I'm hoping millions of people around the world will read it.
Thank you so much for supporting us to get this book. And I hope that it will make many people will read it and just support the fight for the rights of women. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well done, sir. Well done, sir. I think we said it all. I have one of my daughters here who is from Rwanda. Actually, come over and say hello. This is one of my daughter girls.
Oh. Hello.
So this is Lillian Kamikaze, who lost her family in the genocide at 10 years old. She witnessed her whole family destroyed and lived there, survived as a 10-year-old alone for 3 months in the wilderness, and then ended up in an orphanage and got herself to the United States. And, you know, we just met maybe 7-8 years ago. But anyway, I thought she I just introduced her to your book today. And as I was doing this interview, she was visiting
you
here for the week. So
thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, you know, what happened in this region have to stop definitely. And really, we need to fight that this can't happen again. We need really to be enough strong to say this have to stop, to get children who just have this memory. I think that it's our responsibility all to say this have to stop in this region of the Great Lake region.
So, you know what you were saying, this is my final question to you. Thank you. What you were saying, I mean, you were saying we need to reach the men, we need to be able to talk about toxic masculinity, we need to out them for what that is and get them to bring about an understanding. But do you think that's going to happen in your lifetime, in my lifetime? We're the same age. So is that going to happen in our lifetime?
Yeah, I can say that we need to be optimistic, because when we start 20 years ago, you and me and others, for me, it was very hard to talk about this question. It was very hard to address this question. And sometimes I was just in depression to say how people can't understand the suffering of women. But if I can see now how things are moving, when we start, I think 10 or 15 years ago, it was a small movement fighting against sexual violence. But when we can see the movement as a Me Too movement and so on, to see that people now start really to talk about this question openly and bring this question in schools, in university and so on, I can say that maybe we'll not see a world without sexual violence, but this will happen. I believe in it, because I'm sure that the education can make a big difference when people are educated and understand really that it's not a way of to people to live with this kind of atrocities. I'm sure that maybe we're not going to see this happen, but it is happening slowly. And I hope that maybe the next generation can enjoy the world where women are respected.
Okay, final. You know, a lot of people walk around living in fear when they have been intimidated by their boss or intimidated by somebody, you know, even on social media, or intimidated by people in their family. You have been not just intimidated, but have had your life threatened and assassination attempts. How do you not walk around in constant fear that today might be the day? How do you go on with your life and continue to live and grace and bless other people's lives and not live in fear?
Yeah, I want to be very, very clear about this question. I can say that I'm what I am because women did a lot for me. And what I'm doing for women is just to give back what I receive. And this is from my mother to other women I met in my life. The women I treat at Panzi, at the women I met campaigning for the women's rights, and so on. And I think that this all this together is really something that bringing me to don't fear about myself, because okay, what an I'm doing. That's what it. I'm you're doing is what I receive from women.
You're not human. You're an angel. I'll give that to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ofra. Thank you. It was really a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. You can follow Super Soul on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe. Rate and review this podcast. Join me next week for another Super Soul Conversation. Thank you for listening.
Home isn't just a place. It's a state of mind, like curling up in a comfy chair as you watch the world go by.
Good afternoon.
Which is why at Delta, our people do our best to make you feel at home long before you get there. Delta, keep climbing.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.